And so you hope for some kind of unification of all the forces for Stanhope, including gravity. But to realize this dream, of course, you need to have some scenario in string theory where you're going to implement Stanhope. For the past 20 years or so, there have been a number of these scenarios. We just think about the perturbative ones. The main ones are basically the heterotic strings, particularly type of closed string and open strings, D-brakes. Now, for the purpose of this talk, I want to further simplify that second class a little bit. So I'm going to, as far as open strings goes, we'll make a distinction between global D-brake models and local D-brake models. So let me explain to you what I mean by the distinction between those two. So the idea of a local D-brake model is basically motivated by the fact that we have this enormous hierarchy between the Planck scale, where gravity becomes strong, and the TEV scale, which is where we're going to do a next generation particle physics experiments. And because of that enormous hierarchy, we basically don't expect to see any quantum gravity effects showing up in detector experiments. So you might hope that if you want to try to get some particle physics out of string theory, that you would like to work with a scenario where you can basically, if it's very weak, you might try to take a decoupling limit where gravity gets decoupled completely. And that should be enough if you want to describe particle physics for the foreseeable future. So that's the idea of a local D-brake model. So local models are centered around the idea of the correspondence principle, namely, as n Planck goes to infinity, as the four-dimensional Planck scale goes to infinity, you want to keep all the standard model interactions finite, that's a pre-arranged energy scale, but, well, n Planck goes to infinity, so you decouple gravity. So we call this a correspondence principle, because it, in this limit, you reduce to something you know, Gauss theory, and if you make n Planck finite, then it's an extension of Gauss theory. And as I mentioned, the existence of a large hierarchy provides evidence for such a scenario. So with that, that principle in mind, let me show you what the difference is between the global D-brake model and the local D-brake model. So here's a caricature of the global D-brake model. So what I've drawn here is a T2. Ah, there we go. It's hardly visible, is it? So this is supposed to be T2. You might think of it as part of a compactification, six torus, just part of a more general model. Now, over here, then, I've drawn some sets of D-brakes here, okay, which are wrapped around cycles of that torus. And the idea now is that if you want to take the four-dimensional Planck scale off to infinity, okay, what does that do? Well, you take this torus and you send its volume off to infinity. If you do that, four-dimensional Planck scale goes off to infinity. But when you do that, first of all, the cycles along which the D-brakes are wrapped become infinite in size. And since the Gauss coupling, well, 1/g² is proportional to the volume, that means you're shutting off Gauss couplings. Okay. And also, chiral matter comes from intersections, these D-brakes. So in the limit that you send the volume of the torus off to infinity, the intersections get infinitely separated. And that means you're shutting off all your chiral couplings. Well, so if you take just a generic model, and you take this n Planck goes to infinity limit, you shut off all the interactions in the standard model, all the standard gauge your chiral couplings. OK? Now, that's for a generic model, but there are certainly, it's not always true, there are exceptions to the situation. And of course, you know some. One is if you take a stack of D3 brains, you put them on top of each other, you get some n equals 4 units theory coupled to gravity in general. But if you can take a limit, take a low energy limit, or take the 4-dimensional Planck scale off to infinity, and you keep the interactions finite, you're still left over the interacting Gauss theory in the brain, and SUN n equals 4 units theory. It's possible in principle to decouple these things. And you can generalize this, namely, you can put a set of D3 brains at a singularity In which case you get some more interesting gate theories than just pure and Mills theory. And again, so here's a picture. So here we have a collabial. We put our D3 braids, a fraction of D3 braids, at some points on the collabial. So here's a collabial singularity. And then basically you can take the coupling limit by sending the volume of this collabial off to infinity. You still scale things that you have finite interactions. Okay. Now, there are a number of other, of course, in the end, if you want to really do string theory, so in this limit, you reduce the gates theory. In the end, if you really want to do string theory, you have to somehow put this back to your compact collabial.
Yeah, is it possible to stabilize modulus in this gates?
In these non-compact settings, basically all your closed string moduli become, almost all your closed string moduli become non-normalizable models. So they're automatically stabilized. They're not dynamical models. Only when you make this geometry compact. Well, there are two things that can happen. Either your moduli gets some mass contribution from the UV, or they're still massless, and then you have to stabilize them. But this is a question about UV completion theory. Only once you've coupled to gravity, you have to worry about it. Now, in addition to this this correspondence principle, if you want to do model building, there are a number of very practical advantages. And they're basically practical, it's basically gate theory in this limit, so it's not surprising perhaps. So the first is this this Alieffe holography from bottom up perspective. So if I take my D3 brains here at this point in the collabial, as you know from ADS-CFD, the radial direction away from the D3 brains, away into the collabial, the radial direction represents an energy scale. And this is essentially why you need to get a couple. If at low energies, you only explore a small neighborhood of the brain, and as you go up in energies, you see more and more of this compact collabial. Right? You explore more of this compact collabial until you get to this scale of M here, where the collabial is closed off. And that's what we call the Planck scale. Okay. The point is that this kind of locality and energy scale, which of course really allowed us to take the coupling limit in the first place, it also allows us to take a bottom-up perspective, even in particle physics. So I don't have to know the full compactification. In fact, I don't even have to know that this piece of the geometry. I can be completely agnostic what happens above, say, 3 TeV. And if I want to get the standard model, I could just decide to reconstruct this local neighborhood here. Okay, and then whatever comes after that, well, okay, we can try to extend our geometry, but it doesn't validate what I've built over here. So this point was first clearly emphasized in the paper by Adasilo, Ibanez, Cavedo, and Aranga. They put it in the title, in fact. So deep brain is a bottom-up approach to standard model. So the other thing what's very practical about this is essentially related to what Evgeny just said. So in this limit, where you take the volume off to infinity, in practice, you have to put some cuts on. Anyhow, the point is that the parameters in your Lagrangian, the gauge invariant parameters in your Lagrangian, are basically the closed string models, the expectation values of closed string models. And they're set by the boundary values over here. And in this setup, you can just set them where you want. It's completely adjustable. Just when you do gauge theory, you have some parameters in your Lagrangian, and you need to set them where you want. The values will eventually be set by some physics, which you have not yet included, which you see when you make this geometry compact. If you just enter through the low energy gates theory, you can just set these things where you want.
So
dynamics.
But you still keep the singularity.
I keep the singularity. So I always keep this local neighborhood around the brain.
When you say introduce this low stream, say moduli, so because of the singularity, won't it happen that the kinetic energy diverges?
Yeah, the kinetic energy of flow stream models typically diverges with this cutoff. So that means they're not normalizable.
Right, so what I mean is, so the singularity means that some K-level modular complex modulus went to basically the boundary. So you need the singularity, you are at the singularity in the modular space.
The physics is not singular, but the target space looks singular.
So there will be no Lagrangian, Taylor metric which is singular or something.
Physics is completely not singular. I'm doing just perturbative physics, just like an orbital point. Everything's completely perturbative. Yeah, even though the target space, just like orbital fault really, even though the target space is singular, physics is actually not singular. The other point is this point of uniqueness. You've sort of learned that if you look at the gauge theory carefully, or really if you look at the gauge theory where you let the ranks of the gauge group run of all possible values, you can basically reconstruct this local geometry just from the gauge theory. In some cases, it's very easy. If there are no background fields turned on, and you just put a D3 brain in the geometry, and the modular space is the D3 brain, it's the modular space from point in Clavier itself. It's not always that easy. Normally, you have to do a bit more work. But in principle, in open string dynamics is sort of the fundamental bit, and closed string dynamics. Understood the deformations of the open string dynamics. So in principle, you can reconstruct. So that's sort of nice. If you want to just describe the standard model, there's something that's more or less universal around here. Of course, this doesn't mean that I've gotten rid of the landscape problem or anything like that. From this perspective, the landscape says, well, you know, there could be God knows how many completions of this local geometry here. There could be God knows how many ways to compactify this local geometry. That's the shape, that's the signal of the landscape in this context. Okay, now brain set singularities, or generally actually any of the gauge theories you get from D-brains, take a very special form because the degrees of freedom all come from open string models. So that means you get your gauge fields, or you get, as far as scalar fields goes, you get something that looks bifundamental, either an adjoint, or bifundamental means it's fundamental in one group and anti-fundamental in another group. So there are basically two questions that I want to discuss for the rest of the talk. So if you give me a singularity, how do we know the gauge theory corresponds with singularity? How do we work it out? What are the techniques that we know for doing that? And the other question is, can we find some local geometry which describes the MSSM? Yeah. I can pretty much tell you the bottom line in advance. It appears, I can't quite prove this, but having played around with it for a while, get the strong impression that basically any quiver gauge theory that you can write down on paper can be realized can be constructed from a set of brains and sounds in the area. So it's not, this is actually a pretty large class of gauge theories that you get this way. And whether it's good or not, I'll leave the philosophy up to you. But it sure does look like a fear of everything, not in the sense that you want it. Okay, so let me review a little bit about quiver gauge theories. So there are basically going to be two kinds of quiver gauge theories that we look at. There are oriented quiver gauge theories and the unoriented ones. So let's look at the oriented ones first. So an oriented quiver gauge theory consists of a bunch of UN gauge groups and bifundamental chiral fields. You can draw a nice picture for that. So for each UN gauge group, you draw a node. And for each bifundamental, which is in the antifundamental of group I, fundamental of group J, you draw an arrow from node I to node J. So here I have an example. This is a well-known singularity. And there's an additional rule, which says that the number of incoming and the number of outgoing errors at any given node has to be equal. For n larger than 1, this says that the non-abelian anomalies has to be canceled. In fact, this is even true for n equals 1. You can then, even for n equals 1, this has to be true. The universal statement for any n is that the one loop of iter has to vanish. Otherwise, you have a tadpole and you can't satisfy the equation of motion. So that's true in this thing. Here I've drawn something else. In this case, doesn't satisfy rule number 3, so anything that looks like that is not allowed. Okay, so that's oriented quivers. Now, let's just ask if I take these rules, how close can I get to the NSSM? Okay, and here I've drawn basically the best you can do if you stick to these rules. So I'm going to relax those rules a little later, because we're going to work with unoriented quivers. But if I just stick to these rules for oriented quivers, this is essentially the best you can get. So what do we have here? So we have the SU3 sitting over here, the SU2 sitting over here, then I have 5 U1s. And here you see the left-handed quarks, the right-handed quarks, the left-handed leptons, and the right-handed leptons. And then there are the Higgs fields. Okay. The U1s, maybe a quick comment on it. So that it looks like there are 5 U1s. Now, you always find that there's one U1, basically the sum of all the U1s, which is not charged under any of the chiral fields. This U1 just a couple. This situation, you also find that there are two U1s that are anomalous. In string theory, these U1 anomalies always get cancelled by a Green-Schwarz mechanism through Stukeberg coupling. And that Stukeberg coupling at the same time also gives you mass.
Wait, can you comment on this? If the M Planck is infinity, does the Green-Schwarz mechanism work in four dimensions?
Yeah, so it's a little. So it basically turns out. I said that the closed string modes are non-normalizable. It's actually not quite true. There are few normalizable modes left, and they're just enough to do the Green-Schwarz anomaly cancellation. But it's a subtlety I don't want to go into, but I'm happy to discuss it. There are two anomalous U1s here, which they eat an axion, basically, and they become massive. And then there are two additional U1s which you can use for model building. So one of them will obviously be U1 hypercharge, and there's one additional U1 here, which is U1b minus L. And you have to make sure that U1b minus L gets massive. There's a story there too, where we worked out in the paper with Ferdinand, Bjurkan, Malyshev, and Morris in October. I won't get into that, but anyway, it can be done. The U1s, well, it looks like the U1s, but that's not the problem. The main problem here is that, with this quiver, is that, you see, I was not allowed to take an SU2 here, I had to take a U2 here. And with the U2, we had this tadpole anomaly cancellation condition. The number of errors in is the same as the number of errors out. And as you see that there are 9 in here, and there are additional 3 in here, so there are 12 errors in, effectively, which means I need 12 errors out. So I can't just get away with 2 Higgses. I have to have quite a few extra Higgses.
Wait, so can I ask about this? So do this, are these Higgs fields massless, or they can have a major?
These are massless. You can't, in fact, with this quiver, because of the U1s, you can't even write down a mass term for them.
So there is no mass set by some modular way?
It's the mu term is 0 by U1 symmetry. Mm-hmm. Yes. You could have played around with it a little bit and reversed some of these arrows. Then you would have gotten in trouble with writing unclassical Yukawa coupling. So I besides the rules of the previous transparency, I actually imposed one additional rule. I wanted all the classes to be covered, I thought you realize. So then there's just no way out. We have to add lots of extra fixes. And in total, you can't, you know, normally it's 2 Higgses in the MSSM. Here you have to have 12 Higgses, because there are 12 arrows in, so I need 12 arrows out. Okay. So you can do a little better if you work with unoriented models. So what's an unoriented quiver? Well, it's basically a Z2 quotient of an oriented quiver. But if you just look at the rules, so the gauge groups are UN, SON, or actually OM, or USPN, and the pi fundamentals can, as far as it makes sense, it's not just n bar n, it can also be nn or n bar n bar. Of course, for ON or for USPN, n is the same as an n bar. But they're different for UN gauge groups. And then you can also sometimes get symmetric and anti-symmetric tensor matter. And the examples I'll discuss, basically they won't show up. I only have one quiver of some anti-symmetric matter in this talk. So that's not important, I'm not going to leave it out. Okay, so if you now just take these rules for unoriented quivers, and now let's ask again what's the best model you can write down. Well, there are actually some variations. And maybe what's your favorite model also depends on who you talk to. But okay, so let's just take something that's basically the standard model. So this was essentially first written down, Scrivers was first written down in the paper, but even as much as Anna Ramadan. They're a little different, but they're essentially the same. So we had this problem with the U2, we didn't like that. So instead we just got to take a USP2, which is the same as SU2. Okay. Then I won't get into this problem of number of arrows in, number of arrows out. And so in particular, I can have much fewer Higgs fields. I can just take the usual ones. So I've written out 2 models which are slightly different. So let me discuss this a little bit. So first of all, the SU3, I can't make this an ON or a USPN. So this, you're always going to get a U3. I'm going to get around that. Okay. So whatever you're going to get, you're always going to get a slight extension of the MSSN where the SU3 becomes U3. There's always one extra U1. You're not going to get around that. And in most models, this one, certain, what is that U1? Well, it's easy to see. It's charge +1 for the left-handed Qs and charge -1 for the right-handed Qs. So it's baryon number. Baryon numbers over gauges. You can get around, well, you can sometimes, if you, some models, I should just mention it, some of your quarks have an anti-symmetric matter on the U3. In that case, you always come up with your Kawa coupling, so it's going to rule it out from the start. So basically, if you want to get MSSM from a quiver, you're always going to have to add gauges to your own baryon number. Now, that's not so bad, really, because first of all, your own baryon is an anomalous symmetry. So it will, in string theory, it would couple to an axion and get a mass speed in that axion. Okay. And moreover, it's not going to show up as a massless particle. You don't have to worry about that. It will be up at string scale. And it also forbids various, baryon number violating operators. So perturbation theory, you don't have to worry about proton decay or anything like that. So here we have another U1. This is a U1 lepton because it's charged +1 for the left and -1 for the right handed leptons. So there's always a U1. Gauge U1 lepton number. And then the different variations of this model, but if I just take SF2 here, which is basically U1. The remaining one up to linear combination hypercharge. Okay. So this is the MSSM, basically, except for a gauge U1 baryon number and a gauge lepton number. Because I have done, if I have gauge U1 baryon and U1 lepton, I have U1 B minus L, which is not anomalous. That could be massless. So there are 2 ways of getting rid of it. The way I get rid of it in this model is by just coupling to some extra Higgses, I stick in some extra Higgs fields, and I turn on an expectation value. Okay, that's how I get rid of the massless U1 B minus L in this model.
How do you use an expectation value?
Well, this is so far just a supersymmetric model, so it's easy. You just turn on the V for these things, and it's easy to satisfy the F terms and D terms for this. Well, it's easy because you know, if this is massless, then the F terms will be satisfied, then the D terms will clearly be satisfied. Because the arrows go in opposite directions, so if I turn on the equal, then D terms are satisfied as well. Okay, so when I do that, I'll be left over with just the MSSM, except for some massive stuff, which generically will be on the strings, or close to it. The other way you can get rid of the U1 B minus L is by coupling it to an axion. You can't do this locally, but as soon as you compactify, there could or could not be an axion available to couple your U1 B minus L to. Depends on your UV completion. And then you get a slightly different model. So here I have a U1, which comes from identifying two U1s on the cover before taking the Z2-oriented fold. So in this case, you can couple your U1 B minus L to an axion field and get it up to the string scale. In this case, you can't do that if this comes from a projection of a U2. That's a U1 as well, but it can't couple to an axion field. In this case, you'll have to add some extra Higgses and Higgs this U1 B minus L. Okay, so what's the upshot? So basically, this is the MSSM, except there's some extra stuff close to the string scale. Okay, there's another variation you can write down, in fact, but it's not going to do it. Low energy is the MSSM, and okay, they differ slightly close to the string scale. Okay, so this is just from the, you know, this is what we're allowed to write down in principle. It doesn't mean I found the string theory, this is what we're allowed to write down in principle. Okay, so let me switch gears a little bit and now talk about the correspondence between Calabi-Yau singularities and Freeberg-Gates theories. So what's a singularity from my perspective? So I'm working on type 2B string theory. So from my perspective, a singularity is just going to be a collection of two cycles and four cycles which have collapsed to zero size. So here's a schematic picture. So here's a four cycle. And here's a two cycle, here's the point. And the singularity occurs when you take this thing and you collapse it to zero size. And you get a singularity. Okay. Now these four cycles and two cycles which are zero size, we call them vanishing cycles. And on these vanishing cycles you can wrap various D brains. On the four cycle you can wrap some D7 brain, which fills space time and wraps four cycle. On the two cycles, you can wrap a D5 brain, and I guess on the classical point, you can wrap a D3 brain, and the various bound states of this principle. And so a fractional brain is a bound state of these kind of D brains that are wrapped in the vanishing cycles. Okay? So the notion of a fractional brain is really the fundamental object in this game. So what you've got to do, once you have some Calabi-Yau similarity, you've got to find fractional brains. Now it turns out that for every singularity, at least every singularity we know about, there's a set of elementary fractional brains or irreducible fractional brains, which are the lightest at some point in the moduli space. And every other fractional brain, which is not irreducible, can be expressed as a bound state of these irreducible fractional brains. And you know this very well probably from orbifolds. So if I give you an orbifold singularity, the irreducible fractional brains are a one-to-one correspondence with irreducible representations of the orbifold group. So it's, and every other one is sort of a bit decomposed in terms of irreducible representations. So it's true for orbifolds, but it's also expected to be true for general singularities. So then, what you got to do, if you give me a singularity, you've got to find me these elementary irreducible fractional brains. Once you find those, you know everything. Okay. So the dictionary is roughly, yes, you have this similarity. It's a fractional brain. Well, fractional brain is then, right, it's a brain, so there's a gauge group associated with it. So that corresponds to the node in the perfect diagram. And the chiral matter comes from intersections of brains. Right, it's brains are at cycles, so they're intersections of these vanishing cycles. So if you compute the intersection numbers, that gives you the number of chirals and the number of arrows in the perfect diagram. Right. So the whole game gets reduced. You have to find the elementary fractional brains and the intersection numbers, and you can draw the quiver, and then you basically know everything. Now, there's one slight complication. For Orbifolds, folds, this is easy. It's Orbifolds folds for free field theory, so you know the complete boundary state for the fractional brains. Generally, you don't know. If you give me a general singularity, I don't even know what the CFT is that describes that singularity. It will be some CFT, I don't know what it is. Surely I won't know how to write that boundary state in that CFT. But there's a trick you can use, because this is really the main reason for restricting to supersymmetric singularities right now. By supersymmetry, there's a trick you can do. Basically, the point is that if you're just interested in the F-term information of the Lagrangian, so the spectrum, the chiral spectrum, the gauge fields, but also the superpotential, that's the F-term information. So that it turns out, does not depend on the Kato moduli. It's a non-randomization theory, it has a perturbation theory. None of this depends on the Kato moduli. So what you can do is the following. Here I have my Kato moduli space. Over this point in the Kato moduli space, I have my Calabi-Yau singularity with these collapsed zero cycles, collapsed two cycles and four cycles. Okay. And if I'm just interested in F-term information, I don't care where I sit on this Kato moduli space, so I can start extrapolating and go to the large volume limit. The large volume limit means that I blow up the two cycles and the four cycles, so that they become very large. Okay. And when the cycles are very large and the curvature is small, you can use the nonlinear sigma model, the nonlinear sigma model, which is with the coupled then. Then we know what we're talking about. Then we know the D-brains correspond to bundles, which are localized on these blown-out vanishing cycles. So the fractional brains in the limit get mapped to certain collections of bundles that go under the name of exceptional collections. Name. So they're basically bundles which are localized on the vanishing cycles, which are blown up. And those you can use for computation. So if you just want to get F-term information, you can do all your computations in terms of a set of bundles on these blown-up vanishing cycles, the large volume limit. Now, there's a particular class of singularities that we're interested in, which have a single four-cycle collapse to zero sign. So we need four cycles, basically, because we want chiral matter. If you just use two cycles, you can get chiral matter. So if you take a single isolated collapse to four-cycle, this is the old theory of Miles Reed, says there are very limited class of possibilities. Collapsing four cycle has to be what's called the Delpenza surface. The Delpenza surface is either P1 plus P1, or it's P2 blown up at up to 8 points. So those are the only possible, if you get this isolated collapsing four cycle, those are the only possibilities that you have. So those are the only similarities that you could make. As I said, you need four cycles because you want to get chiral matter, and these are sort of the simplest because they have a simple four, just a single four cycle collection of zero size. And they've all been worked out. The ones I need have been worked out in the paper that I wrote quite a while ago. So by this trick, and you find a number, there's the pits of 5, which is a P2 blown up to 5 points. So P2 has 3 vanishing cycles, the class of points, the class of the hyperplane, and the 4-cycle itself, and then the 5 points blown up. There are 8 vanishing cycles. So you're going to get 8 nodes in your quiver diagram. And if you work out the intersections between these vanishing cycles, well, just using these fractional brains that you get from this large volume trick, you find basically this diagram. So it's a little What I mean here is that for every node in this group here, to every node in this group here, there's one arrow. So there will be four arrows for every node over here. And another one, the offensive 8 singularity. So P2 blown up to 8 points. So this is 3 plus 8, which is 11 vanishing cycles. Just 1 second. So here you have 11 nodes, 1, 2, and 9 over here. And if you work this out, this is actually, this square seems to be true. Anyhow, if you work out the number of arrows, you find that there's 3 over here, there's 2 over here for every, between the U3 and any of the U1s, and there's 1 over here between the U1 and 6. Yes?
So you see, you go to from the singular point to large radius, and then what do you use at large radius to? What information do you use? Because we know in topological strings that it's not just analytic continuation. The transformation between large radius and singular point is much more complicated than that. So when you say you go to
I give all talk on that.
But so you just use the intersection numbers of these cycles, or is that the only?
So there are special collections of the fraction braids get mapped through special collections of bundles with some special properties, exceptional collections. So they have to be rigid objects and they satisfy some additional properties. And those exceptional collections are basically known when they're worked out. And then you compute to every bundle has a certain wrapping, D75D3 wrapping number. It's a bound state of D75s and D3s in general. It's not just D75. It's always a bound state. And basically, it's intersection numbers is then intersection numbers of the D7 of brain 1 with the D5 of brain 2 minus the D5 of brain 1 minus the D7 of brain 2. I can justify it in detail, but just to give a flavor. Yeah.
Well, maybe he's worried about the fact that, I mean, different exceptional collections can give you the same singular point, right?
They
are related by mutations and so on.
That's right. And again, it's...
Actually, that's an interesting question. I mean, have you found all the mutations that are equivalent to the NSSM?
Well, you can just take the NSSM and start doing something about it.
Yes,
I looked at it a little bit. Matt Strasberg thought about this, right, a long time ago. Matt Strasberg tried to take the SU3 node. And start doing some analytics on that, and see if you can get a cascade.
Yeah.
And the SU3, you see, is not it doesn't grow strong. Grow strong in the IR, not in the UV. Mm-hmm. So you have to add extra matter first to make it grow strong in the UV.
Well, but now, I mean, that would be for the usual stuff. Like MSSM. But here you have a quiver. So you could try to see if there are different exceptional collections on
You can, as long as you have any from supersymmetry, you can do Zabrakula.
Yes.
If it has any meaning.
But you know that you can do, there are some mutations that don't even correspond to Zabrakula because you could try to play with those things.
But from my point of view, maybe just from the point of view of this talk, you know, the fact that you have different, the fact that you can have different exceptional collections is,
it's not important.
Well, okay, so it's true that if you just give me the complex structure of a singularity, you can't tell the quiver. You also have to specify the Kalin moduli.
Right.
And that says, that tells you which one of these you have to pick.
Okay.
So if you just give me the complex structure of the singularity, that's not enough. So I was a little bit for that. But in principle, if you give me both the complex structure and the Kalin structure of the singularity, then you can pick. Okay, so these two guys I need. So here's two examples of quiver gates theories that you can get by putting brains at singularities. And it still depends at singularities. Okay, so here's a rough outline. I just want the first line of this. I just used the first line of this. So in principle, as I mentioned, all the parameters, the gauge invariant parameters in Lagrange correspond to some kind of closed string modes from this Calabi-Yau geometry. You can work them out, at least qualitatively, sometimes quantitatively. The only one Angular needs for our purposes later is the superpotential couplings. They turn out to correspond to either complex structure model life with singularity, or a particular type of non-commutative deformation itself with singularity. So the point is not so much, the point I want to emphasize is that in principle you can work out this dictionary exactly, but you know, the point is if our idea of a superpotential, there will be some complex structure on the singularity which corresponds to that superpotential.
So you call couplings in this case, they do not depend on the Kalman model?
Yeah, so again I'm a little bit quick, and because, okay. So the precise statement really is superpotential couplings up to field renormalizations.
Yes, right.
So in that sense, they depend on Kalman modulo. But maybe I'll make some comments on it later. But this is the crucial point to keep in mind. Okay. Now, so I've told you about these irreducible fractional brains, but that's not enough. We need to make more complicated quivers. The standard model was not among these simple quivers that I gave you for irreducible fractional brains. But you can make new quivers by Higgsing. So here's this Delpetri 8 quiver that we had before, except I've drawn, instead of the U3, I've drawn the three U1s instead of this U3. And instead of the U6, I've drawn the three U1s inside this U6. Just to help just visualize this Higgsing. So what I'm going to do now is basically I'm going to connect. So I'm going to turn on some VEMs which connect all these purple nodes. Okay. And when you do that, of these U1s that you see here, if I turn on all these VEMs here, of these U1s, only the overall U1 will remain unbroken, and all the other ones are broken. Right? So all these purple nodes over here, they collapse to a single node, which is the U1 which is unbroken. And then I have a bunch of the white nodes, which are not affected. They're not connected by any VEMs. Right, so they can't get a mass, so they'll just survive. So these three nodes over here will give me a U3, and the two nodes over here will give me a U2. Okay. So if I turn on VEMs like this, the quiver I end up with looks like this. Okay. And now you see this starts to look familiar. This is basically the quiver that I showed you before. It's oriented quiver. It has some extra U1s, but modulo is extra U1. Up to a few extra U1s, this is exactly this oriented quiver which I showed you before, which is the best quiver you can get if you broke these oriented rules. Okay. So by taking this and turning on some VEMs, you can get this thing. Now, when you do this, of course, you have to be a little careful. This is, you don't want to break supersymmetry. You want to make sure the D terms are satisfied, and the F terms are satisfied. The D terms is not so hard. It turns out that you need to turn on two FI parameters here, and then the D terms are satisfied. So it should blow up that this to be done.
So this will guarantee that the Higgs get
there? Turning on these FI parameters, yes. And the F terms are a little tougher, tougher in what sense? So I told you that I can basically tune the superpotential because they correspond to complex structure moduli, my singularity. So basically what you do is you tune the superpotential, so that the F terms are satisfied. And the other thing is that typically when you do this Higgsing, if you're not careful, you find some massless, additional Mon-Chiral massless map in here. If you're not careful, you find a number of adjoints affecting the G1. Stop working. There it is. So you also have to make sure that you turn on enough superpotential terms so that these Higgses get a mass, so that these adjoints get a mass. But once you do that, you can work it out what's the potential that you need, and in principle, it corresponds to the complex structure. So, okay, that's that. Just tune the superpotential. One more comment is that it's kind of remarkable. It turns out that this script, of course, falls to just putting a single defibrillator at singularity. So all this structure that you see here, all these gate groups with the standard model and the Caro method corresponds to just putting a single defibrillator at the singularity and turns on some FI terms. It's kind of remarkable.
So what does the modular defibrillate? What would it correspond
to? Which modular defibrillate?
Yes. Do they exist in this set?
Well, I'm not sure which monolith to differ. You mean that any parameter that you can write out in the Gates theory will be some parameter, will be some expectation value of some field in the geometry.
Right, but do they have to be fixed or you can freeze them, right?
They're all frozen in this local setting. It's just Gates theory, basically.
But frozen by hand or they just frozen?
They're frozen by hand, and these closed stream modes, their kinetic terms diverge with the cutoff. Only when you cut off this geometry, literally when you compact the file, are they dynamical and do you have to worry about stabilizing? Mm-hmm. Okay, so this is this oriented model. Now the unoriented models. So we have this model one and the model two, which I've drawn before. Any unoriented model is an oriented fold. It's a Z2 quotient of an oriented model. So here I've drawn the oriented models, which when you quotient them, give you the unoriented models that I showed you before. So maybe I should just go back quickly. So this U3, right, comes from two U3s of an oriented quiver by identifying them. U1 comes from two U1s of an oriented quiver identifying them. The USP2 over here comes from a single U2, which is projected to itself with an SP projection. Right? And that's what you see over here. So these are the two U3 nodes which get identified. These are the two U1 nodes which get identified. These two nodes get mapped to themselves. Okay. And similar for the other quiver, you get something that looks very similar. And now the point is that if you look at these oriented quivers, they look very much like the Dopetsu 5 quiver that I showed you before. The main difference is that you're missing some non-chiral matter. These project to the Higgses. And I forgot to draw here. There's some extra fields over here, which project these additional Higgses, which you needed to get rid of U1 beam itself. But anyway, up to non-chiral matter, this looks exactly like this. Well, there's one more difference. I have one generation here, and three generations. So basically, if you give me this as a 5 quiver and you orientafold it, this you project it along. That basically gives you the standard model with one generation, up to some details. And the main problem is getting three generations instead of one generation. And again, you do that by Higgsing. So here's the idea. Again, this comes from a bigger group, and I've drawn all the U1s. And now all the green nodes get identified. They're all connected by these green lines. Right? So they all collapse to a single node. So on the top there. And all the blue nodes are also all connected. So they also collapse to a single node. Once you've done that and you work out what you get three generations. And a similar trick allows you to get non-chiral matter. Yeah, you have to again make sure that the D-terms and the F-terms are satisfied. The D-terms you just have to check, and that can be done. The F-terms you basically tune so that this bound state satisfies the F-terms, and also so that there's typically lots of non-chiral matter that you get when you do this. You have to make sure that it all gets lifted. And I have to say that in these examples, I didn't completely manage, I almost managed, but I didn't completely manage to show that all the non-carbon matter gets lifted. The problem is this, this is not something you can do by hand. you need some higher order superpotential theorems in this original quiver, and once you write it out, there are literally millions of terms in your superpotential. And if you turn on these values and check it, everything gets lifted, so you're trying to do it on a computer. But even on a computer, if you need too many higher order terms, the number of terms in your superpotential just explodes. And I could almost, but not completely, check that indeed the non-carbon matter gets completely lifted. Now, I don't think that's a big problem. A year or two, you probably check it explicitly. And I've checked lots of simple examples, you can always do this. In general principles, you can always do this.
Again, it still doesn't quite understand. So what prevents non-chiral matter from receiving a mass depending on modulus? What will you want symmetries?
No. So there's nothing that prevents it. I can turn it on by hand. It's a choice.
Yeah, so
in this local setup, it's a choice. So there's I give you say an adjoint, right? And in principle, you can write out a term m trace phi squared from your action, right? And you can just basically choose whether to turn it on or not, and it corresponds to some parameter, some background depth on your.
Is it a discrete choice or a continuous choice? Is it the modulus that has to be stabilized, or is it a discrete choice?
No, it's in these non-compact models, it's always a continuous choice,
yeah.
But it's frozen because its kinetic terms diverge, non-normalizable models.
Yes, yeah, so when you make it compact, then?
When you make it compact, it depends a little bit. It really depends on your recuperation. Okay, so, here.
Welcome.
I don't know if I have time to go into this.
Okay.
Some of these complex structure moduli are basically fixed automatically. Any compact collabial that you try to write down, they're automatically discretized and they can't be varied continuously.
Mm-hmm.
Others, it really depends on your UV completion. You may have to worry about it, or you may have to turn on additional flux potential or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it depends on your UV completion.
So generically, they are non-zero. So there is generically a mass for the non-chiral matter. Or it's model dependent.
I don't know how to put a measure on the spatial UV completions to say whether it's generic or not. I don't even know what's the possible UV completions of this. But I would expect that generically it gets a mass, of course. Yeah, which is its usual theory explication. Making that precise in the context of string theory, Okay, now you probably got the idea if this is the way you make the NSSM, there's tons of other stuff you can make. It's far from unique. Just to mention, it's basically the theory of everything. So this is some examples to show you can basically everything. Let's try to make all possible models of the dynamical supersymmetry breaking that people have written down. So there are a few mechanisms that have been discussed. So. First, the 3-2 model. This is a model from the 80s, after Diamond Seiberg. This model it's known that basically it has, when U3 grows strong, causes dynamics for symmetry breaking. Dash U3 grows strong, excuse me. Now, you can embed this in string theory. So the field theory has an SU3 here, other than that, it's the same. The string theory version has an extra U1, but this U1 is anomalous, and there's an extra axion in the string theory which couples to it and it gives it the mass. So, in the end, you end up with exactly the model that Affleck-Dyne and Seiberg had, very supersymmetric dynamically. So can you get this quiver? Yes, you can. You can take again this defensive file and mix it in an appropriate way. You end up with this model. So this has dynamical supersymmetry breaking by superpotential by turning on this non-perturbative ADS superpotential. That's one mechanism that we know how it works. In fact, this model has another way to break supersymmetry in the region where the gauge coupling, the strong coupling skill for the SU2 dominates. And Schrödinger and Thomas found that this model also breaks supersymmetry dynamically, not by deformation, quantum deformation of the modular space, not by superpotential deformation, but quantum deformation of the modular space. So certainly we can realize both mechanisms. You can realize the 3-2 model and you can realize the 3-2 model. Another mechanism, also from the 80s, well, it's not really understood what the mechanism is, but anyhow. So there's this non-calculable model, it's been argued by Affleck, Dine, and Zyberg, that it breaks supersymmetry dynamically, but it's in the strong coupling regime, so you can't prove it. It's very plausible.
In what sense it breaks supersymmetry? So it has a metastable vacuum, or it just does not feel supersymmetric?
No, these two models have non-supersymmetric. Yeah. So the minimum, the absolute minimum, is about zero.
Right, but can you prove it? So as far as I understand, they can.
It can be proved in this model, because you can tune parameters in such a way that supersymmetry break happens in the weak coupling regime. Mm-hmm. In this model, you can't quite prove it, but because it's strongly coupled in the regime where it breaks supersymmetry, but there are nevertheless various arguments based on anomaly match. So,
does it prove that there is a vacuum, non-supersymmetric vacuum, or it just proves that there is no supersymmetric vacuum? It's not the same.
Well, you see, classically, this theory only has a single smaller space, just a single point. It's the origin. This thing couldn't run anywhere.
Mm-hmm. I see.
So this model actually is the model that Effie Dunn and Zyberg had in the SU5 here. Again, there's just XU1 in string theory, but again, it's anomalous against mass. This model is extremely easy to realize in Brayton singularity. You should just take should overfold singularity. For instance, C3 mod Z2 cross C3, you orient the fold, you didn't have to do anything else. And you automatically get this quiver. So this is actually a very nice way of dynamic supersymmetry breaking. Moreover, part of its attractiveness, even though it's non-calculable, you can't write down any, I didn't have to tune any parameters. There are no parameters you could tune. There's no superpotential perturbative or non-perturbative that you can write down. So even if you couple this to gravity, you don't have to worry that the coefficient of the superpotential start running away. So this should be very robust, even if you couple to gravity. A very robust method of dynamic supersymmetry breaking. And then finally, the latest model, metastable vacuum. Can we get that? ISSS model. Well, what's the ISSS model? It's basically supersymmetric QCD with some mass terms. So certainly you can get that for purpose. That's the part. So here we've drawn the conic fold. Let's take this to be our QCD group, and let's just set the coupling of this guy to be very weak, so it's the flavor group. Okay, this is a supersymmetric QCD with some number of colors, 2n colors, right? And now you're going to just tune the parameters that you enter the regime of ISSS. So basically you've got to turn on mass terms for these guys, which you can do by turning on some H-flux on the conic fold. And then you have to make sure that the quarter coupling doesn't mess things up, so you have to set that small. Okay, you can do just tunings, and you're exactly in the ISS regime, therefore you have metastable supersymmetry break. Theory of everything. Another thing, a big objection that people often make to deep brain models is that there's no real explanation for gauge coupling unification. So there's no rationale for gauge coupling unification. That's really only partially true. So it's true for, so first of all, let me just mention that you can always get gauge coupling unification by tuning parameters. Because in 10 dimensions, you only have a single coupling, a string coupling. And therefore, once you compactify, if all your braids have the same tension, all the gauge couplings will be the same, and they will automatically unify the string scale. Okay? But the problem, of course, is why on earth would all the tensions of refraction rates be the same? In principle, the moduli that you can tune, and you have to put on a potential on this moduli space, and once you do that, what's the rationale? Why should we proceed precisely at that point where all the volumes of these cycles are the same? Well, there is a rationale for at least some of these relations. And the idea is as follows. So the gauge couplings are given by certain Kano moduli. And now it can happen that if you take, so Kano moduli, okay, it's the expansion of some background field, say a B field, in terms of harmonic forms. And now it can happen that if you, a certain linear combination of these harmonic forms exists locally, but you cannot extend it to the UV completion. Okay? As you can almost extend it to some form, but the Laplacian effect, and it will become zero. So we get a master. So what that means is that some of these moduli, the difference between the gauge couplings can get lifted just by the UV compactification effects.
So basically, you reduce your H11?
You're reducing H11, exactly. You're reducing H11 of the global geometry. And so there are a number of ways that can happen here. So if you take a G3 node and a G1 node, the difference between these gauge couplings is precisely one of these cycles, one of these motions you can trivialize. So you can set those equal by compactification effects. And what that means essentially is, I don't really have time, but this is very closely related to Pathis-Lanov unification. They unify the number of colors and the number of leptons in a single group. And you can do one further trivialization, which is a little more complicated, but along the same lines. Basically, the sum of these two gauge couplings minus the sum of these two gauge couplings can also be. The sum of these two gauge couplings minus twice this coupling can also be trivialized. And that gives you one further relation, and that gives you a relation to the strong, the weak, and the hypercharged couplings of this type, where N1 and N2 are two positive integers, which depend on which linear combination exactly you trivialize. The most natural one is when N1 and N2 are equal, in which case this is compatible with the usual Escher-Fock relations unification. So that looks close to the rationale. So of course, grand unified theories predict two couplings, with two relations among the couplings. I predict only one at this point, but it's not as bad as people tend to believe. Okay, one more comment. What happens to the SU3 node, the SU4 strong coupling? Well, if you check the net wrapping number of the SU3 brain, that's the brain and its mirror and the oriented folding, it wraps a certain two cycle in the geometry, and in fact, it appears that this two cycle can undergo a conical transition. So, most likely, what happens, it's practically guaranteed, as this thing grows to strong coupling. This two-cycle and the pads are going to undergo a conical transition. The brain gets replaced by flux. In other words, you get the implementation of confinement due to Clemens Strauss, Clemens and Nunez, and Rafa conical transition. And in particular, the QCD string, therefore, is a closed string of this geometry. At least in some compactifications, it depends on your UV computer, but in some compactification, that means that this QCD string is really just a different mode of the same string, but also gives you the graph. Okay, so here's the picture I tried to advocate. So we have this enormous landscape. And just by imposing what we know from what we know from low energy physics, well, we already end up in a small region like this. And then, of course, there are lots of relations between the couplings that we see at low energies that we believe to be due to certain mechanisms, higher energies. That will cut it down much, much further. So, of course, I don't know exactly where we'd end up, but I think at least this is a slightly different. It's traditional from a phenomenological point of view, but for string theory, somehow it's very radical. Start from the bottom up. Okay, so again, local deeper models that have, if you use bottom up perspective to model building. The main problem is putting everything together. I can build everything locally, I can build MSSM locally, I can build dynamic supersymmetry breaking locally. Now you have to put it together in an appealing way. That's pretty tough. You do get this nice geometric picture of the MSSM, which explains the title of this book. So, you get the MSSM from some brains and stuff, local geometry. But more generally, you can't just get the MSSM, you can basically get anything else. And I've shown you models of dynamic supersymmetry breaking. This approach allows you to parameterize your ignorance. It allows you to sort of a guide to the landscape, how to think about it. But it's still, I don't know, still somehow you have this feeling that the fact that there seem to be this enormous number of vacuum in the landscape should be good for something. And I think still some good ideas needed to see what this something should be. And finally, what do these models predict? Well, it's not very definitive. The one thing you sort of can't get around in any of the Dieber models, as I argue, is that you have this extra gauge variable number. That's sort of the only thing you really can't get out of. Everything else is optional. You can add extra stuff if you want, but this, apart from this gauge D1B, everything is optional. So it would be nice if you could observe it at the LHC. Now, unfortunately, as far as we understand, this gauge D1B should live a few orders of magnitude below the string scale, so it's not very likely that we'll see it. But if you would see it, that would be very nice. I mean, among my favorite scenarios, then. Because for me, that would be a real indication that we did a debrief rather than did something else. Okay, thank you very much.
Any questions?
So are you sure there's no way to get rid of that extra you want? Because from like it every time in model building, we don't get that before. I mean, we can get it if we want, but we don't need to get it.
Well, there's always some extra you want, because the S3 will always, at least if you work conservative over constraints.
But would that be some, I don't know, could you, well,
if you were conservative over constraints.
If that's a turning time to drive the, if that makes sense, that's probably what someone would get in there.
Well, there's some, if you don't work conservative over constraints, you're not restricted to the form of the interaction dictated by generator factors. Any kind of things that you couldn't get normally. Famous examples are spinner representations or E8 or E, whatever, E6 gauge groups. So you can get this from open strings, but it's not conservative. You can't get this from changing factors. So if you require conservative open strings, then your SV3, there's no way out. It has to be E2. It's just follows from the structure. It's open strings.
Any more questions? Then let's thank the speaker again.